Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 9th, 2002, and this session is Nurturing the Moral and Spiritual Lives of Children, How the Church Can Support Parents in the Task of Nurturing the Moral and Spiritual Lives of Children. It is presented by Marcia Bungie, and it is number BUM 2002-10. Let's listen in.
Well, my name is Marcia Bungie, and I teach at Belfries University, and I've been doing a lot of work on issues of parenting and children, partly because we have our own two children, and it raises so many questions. Also, I teach at a church-related college, and so we ask a lot of questions there, not only about the intellectual development of our students, but their moral, spiritual development. We try to have programs, and you know, I get a chance to talk to a lot of students, too, about their background, what happened before they came to college, because a lot happens in terms of moral spiritual formation before college. And I always find it very interesting what they say about their family life. And some of them have some real struggles, even though it's a real privileged group of students. They struggle with things like depression, or alcohol and drug abuse, sexual boundaries, the lack of sexual boundaries, and even a kind of sense of lack of purpose. So you get some very good conversations going with them too, and it makes me then wonder what's gone on before they came here. What kinds of opportunities have happened in their life before they came to college? And then I'm just concerned about children in our midst, in our country, but around the world. There's so many just sort of alarming statistics about the situation of children in our country, that 16% still live in poverty. I mean, that's down from 20%, but that's still one in six children living in poverty. We still have, even though the rates of teenage pregnancy went down, still one in eight children are born to a teenage mother, and we still have trouble with high rates of teenage suicide, and rising rates of teenage depression. So that's kind of what's prompted my further thinking. And I worked on a project with some other contributors just to see what we've said in our tradition about children. Have they been a serious subject of reflection at all? Are they some sort of seen as sort of beneath the serious theologians' reflection? So we went back and we found a lot of interesting things, some sad chapters in the history of Christianity, some very positive chapters. And what I've been doing this week is focusing on ideas about nurturing the moral and spiritual life of children. And I was mining eight practices, or eight kinds of things that the tradition has emphasized that do help nurture the moral and spiritual lives of children. And I find that a lot of sociological studies, psychological studies, also emphasize these kinds of things. And let's see, I should give you one, two here, please. White sheets. It's kind of colorful.
That's fine.
That's okay.
I went back to the room.
Okay. So this week, we've been looking at these eight kinds of ideas, like exposing children to good examples, you know, being a good example yourself as a parent, but having a lot of good examples in a child's life, participating in family service projects, that's shown to be so significant when children do a service project with caring adults, and when they talk about it, it's a very profound experience for young people. Doing something together, not just saying, you go out and do the volunteer work, but doing it as a family or as a community. We talked about reading and discussing the Bible and interpretations of it, carrying out family rituals, and training children in music. That's something not emphasized so much when you read all these books about nurturing the moral spiritual life of children, but in the tradition, that's a big theme. Music is seen as very powerful in the lives of children, and so I put that up, and also appreciating the natural world and cultivating a reverence for creation, which I think is really important now, especially in a consumer culture, where it's very hard when our
houses are just stuffed with possessions to even know what's our basic needs. You know, it's hard for, I think, young people to sort out what is a basic need for survival. And sometimes just going to a camp like that or getting out a backpacking house. Educating, we talked about this yesterday, educating children, helping them discern their vocation and also learning from children. So that's kind of what we've been looking at. And what I wanted to do today was focus more specifically on what could the church do to support parents in their task of nurturing the moral and spiritual lives of children. Because although the church can help children in so many ways, and we can talk about a lot of ways, I think it is very important. It just makes common sense that we need to help parents because they are the primary moral and spiritual agents of a child's formation, for good or for, you know, for better or worse. They are the ones around their children, and even though children are, of course, influenced by their friends, their peers, other caring adults, by the wider community, popular culture, they are also shaped profoundly in very fundamental ways, again, for better or worse, by their parents. So I just wanted to focus a little more today on what could the church do to, you know, really help parents that way. And maybe we could start with just sharing a few concerns about parents, because I think we do think, oh my gosh, well, of course the church already helps parents. But I think a lot of things undermine the importance of parents in our culture and in the church. Because if you just look at our culture, you know, I've enjoyed this John DeGraff's the series so much about just the time bind parents have. Also, the working poor have just not only a time bind, but a time bind and a money bind. Don't even have enough money to really pay for the basic needs of their children. Or in a consumer culture, you know, so many people are focused on their professions. That becomes sort of more your identity, when really parenting is a fundamental vocation. It's a fundamental task that you have. But it's, I think in a consumer culture and in a very individualistic kind of culture, the importance of parental and civic responsibility is kind of being undermined by this focus on individualism. And I brought up this is an interesting book. I don't agree with everything in it, but Cornel West and Miss Sylvia Hewlett did a book on the war against parents. And they have a really interesting chapter in here about, first of all, how we don't get the kind of governmental support that you do in other industrialized countries for parents, the kind of tax breaks, the kind of parental leave policies that they have. If you've been in Norway or Germany, you can't believe it, you know. And we have these discussions where we say, oh, can they do the 12-week unpaid leave? I don't know, it sounds impossible. It sounds like a dream world when you go over there and you see the kinds of paid leaves they have for parents. So they have a great chapter in there, and then another one very interesting about how parents are depicted in the media. Just in kind of demeaning ways, and very, one guy in the Washington Post said it's kind of the only, you can really make a caricature of parents, unlike you can do with a lot of other groups today. But parents, there's a lot of demeaning images and a lot of demeaning talk about how they're so inept or almost unnecessary. So there's a lot of challenges outside the culture, but even in the church, I think, oh, of course, we love parents, we love to help them out. But I look and I see a couple things. First of all, just the teachings of the church about parenting. There isn't a lot of rich teaching about parenting. There's rich teaching about abortion, about contraception, about issues of sexuality, things related, of course, to the family. But when you talk about, I mean, we've had huge debates about abortion, huge debates about contraception, but parenting, you know, we don't have the rich, huge fund of teachings about what does it mean to be a parent and what are our obligations, not just parents to children, but the church. What's the obligations of the church to children? What are the obligations of the state to children? And you look back in history and there's a lot of discussion about, hey, the community's got to help out children. And what is the state? What are the obligations of the state to the children in our midst? A lot of discussion. and the church has kind of let that out. Now, Catholics have a lot of very good programs, especially for poor children, tremendous programs, but their social teaching too, as a guy from Notre Dame has said, it's very thin. And there's much more on, in the Catholic Church especially, contraception and abortion, if you're talking about issues of children, not so much about what is a child, what do we owe children as parents, as the church, as the community around children. And I think mainline churches too have paid even less attention to issues of the family and children, partly because the more conservative fundamentalist Protestant churches took over the discussion of family values. And so it's sort of seen as that the property of the more fundamentalist kind of wing of the church. So the mainline churches have neglected to really speak out about issues regarding children and families. It's kind of family values is left over there. And there's a guy, Don Browning, at the University of Chicago who's trying to do a lot to really generate a richer discussion among mainline churches about children and about families. So, you know, certainly mainline churches do a lot of good things in terms of daycare, speaking out against gun laws, speaking for gun laws, because we still have a large number of children. It's approximately, according to the Children's Defense Fund, 9 children a day killed by gunfire, whether in the home or in the school or in the neighborhood, compared to, you know, just very minute kinds of statistics in Japan or Germany, for example. So, and the other place I see, so I see a kind of lack of attention to parenting in terms of the teachings and just discussions of rich theological debate going on. It's not about parenting or children so much. The other place I see it is in religious education materials, that a lot of times they are so weak. They're not only theologically weak, they're just not even creative. You know, they don't even have nice pictures for kids to color. I taught the 3-year-olds and we had this one curriculum, and it was, we were all struggling with this and trying to find one thing out of 10 that worked. You know, we kept flipping through. Well, there was one on St. Francis. I said, great, St. Francis, that's a great little theme. And even the picture of St. Francis they're supposed to color, you know, instead of little birds and kinds of animals, it looked like a guy in a dark garbage dump. He had kind of flies around him. It was so bizarre, and he looked frightening. So that was their picture of St. Francis. And then they even had a session. This was for the 3 and 4-year-olds. Let's do Job. Oh, okay. Yeah, let's do Job. And, you know, for the 3 and 4-year-olds, that's a good idea. And just the superficial way it was presented with, they said, now, take a couple paper plates. This is so literally true. Take a couple paper plates. Put a happy face on one. With the popsicle stick, and a sad face on the other. And when you tell a story, say how happy Job was. But then, oh, he got sick and all his children died, and his wife died, and he was very ill. But then bring up the happy face at the end, because everything turned out just fine. So that's what you're supposed to do. This was the materials. And you think, gosh, and you know, all the other kinds of stuff coming into children, the movies, the kinds of creative things going on, you know, and then you go to Sunday school and the kinds of curricula are just so weak. Now, there are some exceptions. We've heard some really good examples this week of some wonderful kinds of education materials. But you wonder, why haven't we put the energy into young people when nowadays, you know, like we talk about children as consumers, there's so much energy and money being pushed into helping children become very young consumers. You know, it's just unbroken kinds of exposure to what you need to buy as a young child, even a 3 and 4-year-old, in McDonald's, in the stores, how the movies are interwoven with the toys. And so all this energy and creativity putting into that, and then we don't even have the materials. And the other part of the materials that I think are very weak, but people like the Search Institute and the Youth and Family Institute are trying to address these, is just they don't involve the parents. It's still, there's kind of this mentality still that the pastors would never say they want their parents to drop off their children, but there's still a sort of sense, yeah, you're taking care of the moral spiritual formation, and when there's not this real intentional way of pushing what's gone on in the Sunday school into the home. Now, there are some really great programs that are trying to do this, like the Search Institute, Youth and Family Institute, a woman named Marjorie Thompson, too, who started a program where basically she said, hey, the parents are the primary moral and spiritual agents of a child's formation. So we've got to help facilitate that in the home. Because even if you had the best program in the world, the most wonderful one-hour program, and nothing went on at home, but you have 27 hours of TV, you know, 5 more hours of computer games, Nintendo, Game Boy, you add it all up, and nothing else is going on to kind of support what's being said in church, it doesn't matter much, 1 hour compared to 27 of just television, which is the average amount a child watches under 18. You can hardly believe it. It sounds like, wow, how did that really happen? But, you know, a couple hours in the morning, a couple hours at night, there you are, 3 times 7, that's 21 already. And that's the average. Even now, I think there's a tremendous amount of young kids under 5 who have a TV in their own room. It's like 50% of kids under 5, something like that. It's just startling. So, anyway, you see that in the materials, kind of, and the lack of interweaving what's going on in the church and the home, I think, this neglect.
I work in audiovisual media some of the time, and I know a number of Christian producers, fellow producers, who absolutely refuse to have a TV at home.
Oh!
They're producers,
yes.
But they refuse to have a TV
wow.
at home.
Uh-huh.
And I just feel like that stuff that you just said is so powerful that I can't see how the church can ever compete with materials.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, you know, in my guts, it's not my brain, but it's in my guts.
Yeah.
It just feels like the only way would be a complete separation of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't be a Christian. Can't be a Christian and watch TV.
Uh-huh.
I almost feel that that's...
It's
a little bit overstated.
Yeah.
It's overstated, but it's
yeah.
but it's realistic because I do this faith incubators program.
Oh, you do? Yeah, people have said that's wonderful.
It's wonderful, but to pretend that the parents are going to do their part is a charade.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're too busy.
Yeah.
They're all working.
Mm-hmm.
They're all part of the system of buying, you know, screen time for the kids because the parents aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep thinking, but I don't think you can. I think the idea of two jobs in one family is intimately linked up with the phenomenon of who gets to raise the kids.
Mm-hmm.
The marketplace does.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, I don't know.
Yeah.
Better materials?
Yeah.
Will they get out the church door?
Will they get into the families? Right.
You know, I'll stop here.
No.
The cost of producing those attractive media and the values that drive them to be so powerful in children's lives are both anathema to the church.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we even trying to compete?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we demand abstinence
mm-hmm.
for media?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a frustrated dad
mm-hmm.
who also works too hard, but for the church, I work too hard too long for a good cause, and it's no different for my kids.
Yeah.
If I'm not there, doesn't matter what I'm doing.
Right.
But I did that. When you said, you know, preaching on parenting, preaching on, not preaching, teaching.
Teaching,
It's so true.
Yeah. Well, I want to think some more real concrete ideas because it is powerful. You know, even our son got a Game Boy from his grandparents, and we said half hour a week he can try this Pokemon thing.
Right.
It is something. He's stuck. It's funny. We even read it can be detrimental to your health. You know, she says, well, I'm glad we're limiting to the half hour. And the half hour, but it fills his mind. It's so mm-hmm. powerful and so engaging, you know, that it's in there as if he'd done it like 10 hours a week. Mm-hmm. It's in there with that half hour. So I struggle with that too. We don't watch the TV, we watch movies now and then. Because one time I saw, you know, I thought, hey, let's watch some Saturday cartoon. We used to do that when I grew up. So we sat down there, he was like 3 years old. I thought, hey, you know, let's just go down there, check it out. And it was like the power of those commercials, it was almost visceral. I want that. You know, his whole body was like, oh my goodness, you know, what can you buy?
It was the show, it was the commercial.
It was. And so I said, hey, that's enough of that.
They're in a race.
Yeah, and even the cartoons themselves, even the commercials are just disgusting now. I watched them one day because I just wanted to see what I have first graders. I want to see what they're watching because most of them watch TV in the morning, except a few parents do not allow it. And I can't, they're disgusting. At least the cartoons, at least that I remember, and I hardly watched any TV growing up, but when I, the stuff I remember, it was just different. It was like a light humor, you know, fun, innocent kind of not violent humor. But yeah, that's and what do you do? I mean, there are these obstacles, like we're saying, you know, in outside the culture and then within the church, outside in the culture, in the church.
I think you'd have to deal with it. I mean, to some degree, you just, that's the time to, I suppose, voice your disagreement with what's going on, because those kids are going to have that in their life, and you can't always shield it from them.
I know that's the question. That my question, because it's about like what you're saying about absence. I don't have my own kids yet, but I had a lot of thoughts about how I intend to raise children, and because I'm a teacher and I have kids, and think a lot about how I was raised. When I grew up 5 years of my childhood in Africa, we didn't have TV, we didn't have. I wouldn't trade that for anything. And everyone I've talked to who had a similar experience, you know, growing up overseas, same thing. And my mentality, and I know that this isn't realistic, is always, I'm going to take my kids somewhere, my future children. I don't have yet, but you know, I'm going to take them somewhere because I don't know how to do it in modern. I mean, I know, I fully intend. I mean, Eric and I have a TV right now. We watch very little TV. We watch maybe 2 hours a week total, maybe. But we think when we have kids, we want to get rid of it completely. We just don't even want it in the house. Because like you said, you did half an hour a week for your son for Pokemon, and yet that was in his brain.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to do. I don't know. I'm really. I see my students, I have 6-year-old students, the things they see and do every day, except for maybe 3 families out of each class where parents are extremely intentional in their parenting, and they just don't allow, you know, they just flat out don't allow, and they discuss with their kids why, and the kids are a little disappointed about it at times, but they can't.
Yeah.
And they don't even get to go to some friends' houses because they know at those houses, they'll be watching the movies the kids, parents don't want them to see.
That's real important. You can't just go and play at the neighbors because they watch everything.
Right.
And you want to be good neighbors.
Exactly. I know.
It's stunning.
And
my wife says we have to let them have this to a degree because otherwise they're totally
awesome.
That's what she was kind of saying. Yeah.
Exactly.
So they're culturally literate in some way.
40 years ago when I had my kids, we had a couple of nights a week where we did not turn on the TV. They knew those were no TV nights. Right. Just because we wanted them to be able to remember that they could read and play games and
sure
things. Yeah. But to just, I think it makes it more enticing
to have.
Not have it at all.
One of the things that I've noticed, and I'm sure this is across the board, there are two or three, there's one evening in the week when there's a couple of shows that I really, really enjoy, just as a mindless watching, but I love the characters in it. And quite often it's an evening that I can't make it, so I tape it. watch it later in the evening after I come back from my meetings and so forth. And which is really wonderful because again, fast forward commercials.
Right.
But you absolutely do not realize how many commercials are snuck in every few minutes until you actually sit there and fast forward.
Uh-huh.
And uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, they don't have one commercial or two commercials. There are probably 8 or 10.
There's six in a break. Six in a break.
At least 6 or 7 in a break.
Later in the movie, there's more and more of it.
Mm-hmm. But I had absolutely, until I did that and started taping this show and then fast forwarding through, I did not realize. Now, I never watched the commercial, I'll sit down and pick up a book and read or, you know, whatever. But, and one other thing, real quickly, is that when we brought 15 grandchildren up here. 16, 17, 16, anyway, whatever. We brought a whole batch of them up here last year. And they were not allowed to bring any Game Boys or anything with them. And you know what? They never missed it. Mm-hmm. They never missed it. And still, you know, sometimes I go to their house and I feel like they're really attached to their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I have a friend that had carpal tunnel surgery because she's gotten so stuck on one of these stupid.
And
she's 50 years old. It's stupid.
People saying too, now in the car, which used to be really quality talk time, the car is fully loaded, and people are so proud when they've got the video. The kinds of things you can plug in, separate earphones, so you can have separate games going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something. It's like, wow, where are people talking? And then if you don't have dinner together anymore, you know, the statistics show very few people have dinner as a family. 70% of adolescents eat a dinner alone or watching television. So that's tremendous. You know, where is the time? Where is it coming? It was kind of interesting. I asked John DeGraff, because he was talking about, you know, working less.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, even if you work less, is there a correlation with, wouldn't you just fill it up with more TV? Is there any, because there's this guy, Doherty, in Minnesota, who does so much wonderful work on intentional families and the kind of ritual you can create in your family. He says the two obstacles to wonderful, rich rituals in the family are, of course, the time buying, money buying outside the home, but inside the home is the technology, the computers, the TV, the Game Boys, the Nintendos, those kind of things. So I thought, well, even if you got rid of the time buying and had more time, would you just fill it up in our culture with more TV? And he said, they showed in Japan that the more you work, the more you do watch TV. You're just so tired. And then in Japan, when they cut the work hours somewhat, the rate of watching television went up for a little while, but then it went down. So it was very interesting. He thinks there's a real strong correlation between, you know, too much work, too much TV.
And too much sports.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I think the reason most of them don't eat dinners together is because this kid's going up to soccer, and this one's going up to ball, and this one is coaching, and, you know, so one of our families has 4 members out of 5 all involved in some of all.
Yeah.
One every night of the week. Mm-hmm. And double hitters. I mean,
right.
When
you're supposed to
be a family.
Right, now it's gone into Sunday. Like there's actually games. Not just practices, but games on Sunday mornings in our town.
We're sitting at that ice time.
Yeah, hockey. Minnesota hockey ice time.
The superintendent of our school finally put the, you know, he's talking to the coaches, thank goodness, because there's a lot of community discussion among the pastors and the teachers and the parents. That's good, one real positive thing, this, the community, because he has some authority. He can't just say, you can't have practices, but he can strongly encourage the coaches not to on Sundays, but it's just pathetic.
Yeah, some people have had some luck that way.
An example of something that happened this year, my daughters both dance, and my older daughter's in hip-hop class, and they picked a song, and the teacher told and she's 16, the teacher told the students to discuss with the parents the song they picked, because it was called The Last Resort, and it's full of suicide language.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rap song.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that music is I guess we'll call it pretty raw, pretty edgy music. And I felt in somewhat of a conflict when I heard that, because I would not tell my daughter, I would not censor what they read, you know, in terms of novels and things. And I don't really want to censor their music. But when we talk about what parents can do, what the church can do, it gave us an opportunity to talk about it. Because she did, she said, I need to talk to you about this. So we talked about it. It gave me an opportunity to say, well, what do you think of the music? I watched the dance. They did a blow-up dance at the recital, and it was very good. And actually, the music, the music behind it, I liked. I happen to like watching them do hip-hop. It's real athletic dancing. But it did give us an opportunity to talk about, well, what do you think about suicide and last resorts? So, you know, when I hear we have to, no media, that's censoring.
Yeah.
And eventually these children will go off and I mean, I've read novels, very old novels that had stuff that really shocked me, but you have to be still, you get exposed to it. But if there's no time, if both parents are working, you don't have dinner together, you don't have time to say, well, what do you think about that TV? What do you think what she's wearing, or what, you know, like an MTV, what, you know, there's a lot of suggestive stuff in there. What do you think about, you know, her being the object of all this attention from all these guys in this video? They see it and they don't know what to think about it unless a parent or an adult can sit down and say, let's talk about, what do you think? You know, is she being an object? Is she being, are they treating her right? But someone has to be there to see these stupid TV shows that the teenagers watch. They're all this real life stuff. They're, you know, the island where they, they're all on this island and they kick people off.
We talked about on Wednesday, which was a good idea, you know, some people saying you can talk about it together, things that really are disturbing, you can talk about that together. But if it becomes the dose, the main dose of what they're getting in terms of the music, the television, and that's, and you're not there talking about it, but it's the main dose, you know, and when you look at those headphones kids wear, even in the car, it was just piping through their mind, and that's what's going through their mind over and over.
Is there a correlation between that and the depression? My daughter reports that a lot of young people are depressed in their high school.
There is a high rate of teenage suicide and depression.
Well,
I have to say,
she tells that depression and drama, just everything is so dramatic. And people aren't just sad for today; they're depressed. And I don't know what's feeding it, but I suspect it's just large doses of.
Well, and then you think, what are they doing? They're watching TV, and what's not happening? Everyone said, oh, well, it doesn't really get in their mind. But what's not happening? We talked a lot about, you know, that the impact of those service projects. If you're out there doing something with them, they feel maybe more needed. There's so few ways we have children feel like, and young people, that they're really needed. It's almost like, oh, you don't have to do anything, you know, till you're 29 practically and you get out of school, and then you'll be a responsible citizen. But if you don't cultivate it early, that, hey, you've got something to contribute here, even in the home with chores and then later with community service, that should be chipped away at all their growing up, you know. Otherwise, it is a kind of sad life. It's very myopic. It's very self-centered. So, I don't know. I'd like to talk about these. These are some ways I was thinking, but I'd like to hear more ways, and maybe we can come back to the media thing. But I did think, now, and I'd love to hear if you say, that's not going to work or at all, or it's not the most important thing. But I think just even talking about the central role of parents, and saying more about it, lifting it up as a sacred vocation, as a true calling, as a divine thing you're doing, we don't hear that. Parents don't get the encouragement. You know, it's like, well, you chose to have your kids. It was your personal choice. We don't have that rich kind of language of, hey, you're doing a task not only for those children, but for our community. because those children are going to be gifts to our community, or they're going to end up also being threats to our community if they don't get a good upbringing. So I don't know, just real richer ways of talking about parenting.
And it goes even deeper than that. We don't, society as a whole doesn't value child care workers.
No.
And which is, I know, you know, my daughters that are working, they hunt like crazy to find the best possible care.
Yes.
Because, I mean, they're going to be the mother while you're not there.
Even
they don't pay them well enough, and they don't give them benefits they should have.
No. The turnover rate. The Children's Defense Fund has this, they compare what you need to become a hairdresser. You know, like this 15 hours of practice, but to become a daycare worker in like 30 states, there's hardly any requirement for what you need to do to be trained.
Well,
to
even
do
if you have the credentials and have a early childhood degree and this kind of thing, it's, if you're in the daycare setting, you're not going to make much money.
But some way to lift up the value of it, to honor it as a really significant thing you're doing would be a parent. We don't have that rich language talking about parenting like we do other tasks, you know, even the ordained ministry or a teacher. We don't have that language at hand to articulate, wow, this is a sacred divine calling we have. I love this notion of the family as a little church that a lot of people, Bushnell, Chrysostom, 4th century, a lot of theologians have brought up, because it's so powerful. It's saying, hey, you've got to practice the worship, the prayer, the teaching in your home, and not just be caring for your own little tribe there, but as a little church, you also help the poor and marginalized. You are out there kind of as a vehicle of social transformation as well. That's what a church is about, not just, oh, aren't we so great? We're such a cute little community. We love our own. It's getting out there and helping the poor and marginalized. I think having that kind of thought about what's our little family about, it helps. Or Luther talks about parenting as a divine calling. He talks about parents are priests and bishops, apostles to their children. I mean, that's very powerful language, isn't it? You're an apostle to your kid, because he said not only are you teaching them a lot in that sense, you're an apostle, but you're also helping them get out and serve the community. You've got to get them a good education, you've got to get them trained, you've got to help them with their own vocation so they can get out there and serve others. So it's this kind of real rich spiritual life in the home, but getting out and serving others. So and then of course, some suggestions to help parents. I think a lot of parents don't know where to begin. They either didn't have good models in their own home, or they're working so hard they don't know how to chip away, where to go, and they need some nice suggestions. A lot of people don't pray together, for example, at a meal. They're not having the meal together, but just it seems a little funny, it seems a little odd, or reading together. So these 8 practices I was talking about this week, I think that's a beginning. You know, family service projects, reading the Bible or interpretations of it. If some people feel a little uncomfortable reading the Bible, even just reading a kind of novel that brings up issues of spiritual life is very positive. Our family, getting in that practice of we read together as a family, so we can talk about stuff, but we read out loud, that's a very powerful tool that helps you feel connection in your family too. It helps build identity and connection as a family.
It's probably one of those things that could be done in the car. Just get a really good novel.
Yeah.
On a long trip.
Yeah. There's a neat little thing that
for older children.
The Youth and Family Institute has too. If parents feel a little uncomfortable, they have a little game called Faith Talk Cards. Has anyone seen those? They're kind of nice. It has a little spinner and 4 areas like memories, faith life, I think, service. And they're little cards like, what was your favorite hymn? What's the favorite song you have and why? Or what do you think God is like? You know, they'll have these little questions that it's almost like a little game you can have after supper that prompt a few questions about, well, what are you thinking? What are some of your values? What are some of your ideas about God and yourself? and what are some important things in your life. So that little game is kind of fun.
Some of the curricula I've used with youth have had take-home pages like that, where they discuss a lot of things, to discuss their family, their father and mother's traditions,
yes,
and all kinds of things.
Right.
But I still don't think they've ever, you know, I question afterwards. They don't ever happen.
Yeah.
It's really hard to actually get it to happen.
Uh-huh.
So,
right. Even
did you
if
talk
you got
about,
the ideas.
Well, no. Even if I give it to the parent,
uh-huh,
it's still the kid.
Well,
you planted the seed.
Planted the seed.
What are those things called? Safe cards? Safe talk cards. Safe talk cards.
It's that kind of thing, though. I like
yeah
that.
Well, I think all the things we talked about today, you know, that service projects, oh, it's so powerful, those doing something together to help the community is a very powerful teaching tool for young people. It helps them feel worthwhile. The music, singing something together, these rituals of worship, prayer, and service are important. The getting out in the natural world, this Pfeiffer, she prescribes, she's a the one who wrote Reviving Ophelia, the one who talks about anorexic girls. She has a book on parenting, and one thing she says, I prescribe to these families in trouble, go out, go camping. And you must go camping, you can't see me till you come back after you've gone camping. And she thinks it's really great, and we talk about more about this on Wednesday, but it's kind of, you get out there, you see your basic needs, there's some family connections, you're creating memories. So I think that's a very important thing too. And the other ones that I had mentioned. I'll just say a couple of things and then about these programs. And again, maybe they're not going to take if parents don't do more in the home, and that's certainly true, but it would be helpful to have a few strong religious education materials that, and to challenge parents to, you've got to do this more in the home. This Marjorie Thompson, I had her on this bibliography back there called the Faith Forming Center, something like that. Marjorie Thompson, she started a program where it's, hey parents, you are the teachers, you're the Sunday school teacher, you're going to do it all at home. And half the church left and said, we don't want to do that, man. I don't know what to say about the Bible. I never read it much myself. I don't know what to teach. So, but then once those people left, it was very attractive because it gave parents just a kind of way to get talking with their kids about issues of faith. Mm-hmm. So it's now just a booming church down in Texas where she started this program, just because they got the families kind of saying, I'm sorry, you've got to take up your role more intentionally. So here's how to do it. Here's some guidelines, because some of them don't even know where to begin with a prayer. What do you do? I think also ways to support all families and to ways to prevent divorce, even though we say that divorce in some cases is beneficial to the children. Certainly in high conflict, abusive marriage, it's beneficial to the children. But what's been so surprising to me lately is sociologists and psychologists are talking more about this than mainline churches. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a silent thing, we're not talking about that. But here we got these sociologists, psychologists, Popino does wonderful work, this David Popino, Wallerstein, she's been in the news quite a bit. Who's done studies on children of divorce, or this Sandifer, who did this tremendous book about children of divorce. They're seeing some of the effects, and certainly, again, young kids can thrive in single-parent families. It's beneficial in some cases, but why isn't the church speaking out more to help prevent divorce? Or then once, if there are step families, single parent families, providing some concrete support for those families. I do love that about fundamentalist churches are doing very concrete things to help families. You know, saying, hey, you need a ride to work, very concrete things. I think mainline churches are more reluctant to talk about that. It's kind of your business, it's your private business with your private family, and we don't talk about that. So there's one study that only 8% of congregations offer parenting classes, and only 7% of Protestant churches emphasize helping parents promote faith in their children. And even among those classes, a lot of times it's it's kind of just reading psychological studies, which are really helpful, but it's not the rich theological, spiritual depth of it. It's almost like, hey, why don't I go to a church? I can sit here and read Brazelton, this wonderful pediatrician, you know, or Penelope Leach. I can read all that. I can read Robert Coles. I don't need to go to some washed out version of Brazelton at my church. You know what I mean? So it's almost like it doesn't even offer much new when you read some of this stuff on parenting in the church. So, boy, why it's not a subject for a lot of these churches. Or, you know, helping children participate in worship. Child care programs are very helpful, attending the needs of poor children. I do think the church could do more with local and federal legislation. I'd like to hear your ideas, but just increasing the minimum wage so that it's a working wage for these families that have to have two jobs. It's amazing. 90% of the children who do not have health care, their parents are working parents. So it's we've done a lot with this CHIP program that works together with states to get a lot more health care out there for poor families. But still, of the families, children who don't have health care, their parents are among the working poor. So that, I think this idea about the time, working fewer hours, is very good. Did you guys hear? John DeGraff's going to have a big national initiative, October 24th, 2003, where it's called Take Back Your Time Day. And the reason it's October 24th is because if you lived in Germany or some of these industrialized countries in Europe, that's when if you'd worked all year, you'd have the rest of the year off, because that's how much vacation you'd get. So October 24th is, and he said last night or the night before, 25% of families had no vacation. No, of working people had no vacation. That was startling to me.
Oh, wow.
No vacation. And here you get, you know, in Germany, hey, everybody gets 6 weeks paid vacation. They think it's important and very productive, too. So that kind of thing, or health care for all children, providing parental leave policies. I think the church could do more and speak out more in that way. And then just providing a richer theologically and biblically informed view of children. I put on the top of that white handout what's gotten me so upset recently, just looking at how we view children, that I put here, keep in mind, the little second paragraph, because I think, first of all, we don't think much about children. And then when we do, it's often in narrow ways, like with the market mentality as commodities, consumers, or economic burdens. Or kind of we think that little kids are real innocent and pure, but the teenagers are dark and sinful, kind of horror creatures. Or kids aren't even human quite. They're on their way to becoming human. And there's just a really rich way of talking about the tradition. We've neglected it very often in the tradition to speak of children only as sinful and in need of instruction. But if you look at the whole sweep of the tradition, you see these rich ways. They're gifts of God, source of joy, sinful creatures, moral agents, developing moral capacities. Not just when they become 18. We struggle so much, you know, with these cases of kids who killed somebody and they're like 12. So, like, are they totally innocent victims or horrible, evil creatures? We're going to lock them up for life. It's almost like totally either or, because I think we don't talk enough about developing moral capacities of kids. Or they're also made in the image of God, fully human, worthy of dignity and respect, moral witnesses, models of faith, sources of revelation, and orphans, neighbors, and strangers who need to be treated justly. I think that would help if we talk more about just who are children. Who are children? That would help us take this test more seriously, maybe. So those are some ideas that I had. I want to say, even though I was focusing on parents, it's certainly a cooperative task between the home, the school, the community, the church. Because even if you do as much as you can at home, but other people aren't affirming your values outside, other adults caring for your kids, loving your kids, they show with those assets with this Search Institute. You know, children need a lot of people around them really caring about them and being able to name their gifts, that really love them and are interested in them as people.
I think, I don't want to get in the whole problem right now in the Catholic Church with some of these abuse cases, but with children, but it is something when you think about the bishops who kept passing around those priests into different congregations. What if they hadn't had a really rich view of children as fully human beings? I know it was other things we talk about, you know, other struggles, but that's maybe one component too. We don't even think of them. They're almost pre-human. So, I don't know, to kind of get over it. So I think that might help. But what are you? What are some other ideas? You know, because maybe the time bind, the money bind, the consumer mentality is so strong, the church can't do too much. Or what other ideas do you have?
Marcia, do you know of any studies, the churches that have really invested in a pastor or a staff person who is devoted to family and youth ministries, it's becoming really popular.
Yeah.
There's a shortage of qualified people to do it. I know in our
family
we're always looking for that. I wonder if those situations, if they have found success, or do you think it's probably too early to do any kind of study on the ways that those congregations have maybe been more effective in the ways that they've supported families than just depending on the volunteers or the pastors who maybe already have way too much on their plate.
Yeah.
And or does anyone here have a youth and family ministry program at their congregation? And then again, we end up in these smaller churches where you just can't feasibly support a staff person in that area. So once again, the pastor is supposed to do it all.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard.
A lot of times, I mean, I think it certainly is a wonderful statement, too, if you say we are committed so much to our young people that we do have a person full-time, and that person is around for the young people, and that we treat that as a priority in our church. Because, I mean, McDonald's knows better than some churches.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they have the little reading programs with Pizza Hut for first graders? You know, and McDonald's coupons for reading, it's because you get that in your habit, you get it in your taste buds. Hey, we want lifelong consumers, and we're going to start early. So why isn't the church there? It's almost like we always say, well, you know, we'll kind of float along, and then we hope they become strong members later, but it's got to be much earlier.
Well, we hear a lot of people saying things like, you know, most of us stopped going to church in our 20s, and we all came back again.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand statistically that that's not true of the current generation.
Mm-hmm.
They are not all coming back again.
Mm-hmm. You know where they're coming back to is more conservative fundamentalist evangelical churches that have programs for families.
Right.
They draw them in with the child care. They draw them in with the family program. Mm-hmm. And that is a way they are growing. The mainline churches are not growing. They're declining, most of them. And one guy was saying, every year I look at the average age of the members of the ELC, it's the same as my age. It never gets, I'm never like older, because it keeps getting older. It keeps getting year by year, the average age. So that's something that they are, boy, they go to bat for families, and they're very welcoming to all family structures, even though they hold up very strongly, hey, we want the intact two-parent family, we don't want divorce, we want strong marriages, we're going to do some things to help these marriages, but even though they lift up that as normative, they're very welcoming. The black churches are like that too, very welcoming. We know we got single parents here, we got step families here, come on in, but we're going to hear your needs, and we're going to respond to those needs. And I don't think mainline churches are as
intentional
about that. Yeah,
we have what's his name? That he was called a rockabilly evangelist, Lindholm. No. Anyway, we Celebration Church, which has been meeting at the high school for several years and had an office space, and now they have decided they're ready to build. They've got the money, they're ready to build their house, build their church south on 35W. Anytime you go south on 35W, look to your right, and it is there. And
we'll move back up. What state are we talking about?
Minnesota. Anyway, they not only they do a better job than McDonald's. They have a
an evangelism thing, and they put a big, huge tent up every summer in the parking lot of the high school. And they have the bouncy things for the kids, you know, those air-filled things that they get into. And they have merry-go-rounds, and they have ponies, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, they have almost a fair atmosphere. And then the big tent, and at a certain time, the kids are welcome to come, like, from 4 until 7 or whatever, any old time. And then they have food stands, and then they take them into church and evangelize to them.
Wait, this is like on, is this like a short time frame that they
do
this?
Right, it's about 3 or 4 days. They bring in big music names. They bring in big names of great musicians. I mean, it's in a way, it's like a carried away Billy Graham. You know what I mean? Because they bring, I mean, the kids,
do
the places
stay?
Packed.
Do people stay? Like, once they get, you know, connected up, do you know?
I do not know. I do not know. I do know that the place has been growing, and I do know that their, you know, their advertisement and all this kind of stuff. But I mean, they've taken it so far, and I don't know their programs. I don't know anything about it. But I mean, you know, we talked about the McDonald's giving the kids the little toys and the Pizza Hut reading program and all this kind of stuff. Well, this church really draws the kids in with all their little toys and their little fun things. And then I'm sure there's program beyond that. I mean, I've seen the names of some of the people. Mm-hmm. But
I think that's something that's happening even in the little town of Livingston. The church, one of the churches did that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
And had this kind of a rally with all these wonderful attractions for families.
Really. That's me. Some people have made Vacation Bible School real family Bible School almost. Mm-hmm. And then, but they try to make it almost a kind of a neat counterculture type thing. Like one guy in Madison does a wonderful job every year. It's just all the families love it. And it's like we're going to make something of integrity during this week. They make like a dulcimer, or they make something that really, you know, you don't throw away. It's sort of junk stuff. And a lot of the stuff too, it just even passed out at church, is sometimes it's this little junk, more and more plastic junk. Yeah. And it's kind of like, hey, we're working as a family to make this thing of integrity. It's an instrument or a vase, a pottery thing.
We built a fountain.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Something meaningful. Something that helps the community.
A couple of things I want to comment on, and I want to spin back a little bit. First of all, was on media, and this is going to be very anecdotal. We got rid of our television when our daughter was born, right? And this idea of being ostracized because we don't have a TV. Over the 12 years that we've been without one, we've learned that when you're a Christian, you are going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be ostracism. You don't have to view it that way. You can cultivate your difference. She encounters in school, that we encounter in our workplace, because we actually live in a sort of a parallel universe. We don't get half the jokes that people are talking about as adults, because we're like expatriates. And that's great. People now have identified us and identified our daughter as that kind of a different person for a very intentional reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not bad. That's not bad. And she's learned how to handle her responses to the people who would possibly ostracize her. So I think it's okay to be different and not worry about that.
Yeah.
As long as you can strengthen it in the family. And the other one was with regard to worship and participation in worship. We very intentionally, throughout the year, visit other congregations.
Mm-hmm.
And we're lucky, we're in Seattle. There's a very rich panoply of liturgical experiences. One of which I thought was really significant. We went to St. Spiridon's Russian Orthodox Church. They have a fair every year, and you can go to Evensong there and that sort of thing. And our daughter focused in on one of the icons that they have for sale there. Got herself an icon, and that's an important part of her room now. Is that she's got an icon. That's not necessarily our strongly Protestant view of how worship is done. But if she wants to dwell in the midst of God, that's fine with me. I mean, we're Episcopalians, and we couldn't mean that way anyway. you know, that's okay. So do things that are different. Do it intentionally. We've also deliberately visited the Bouncing Ball Church with the music, where in the program they give credits to the PowerPoint person.
And, there's some good things about that. You're seeing up instead of into your...
And she walked out and she said, that's not church, Dad, it's theater.
But it's neat. It provides occasion to talk about how you enter in the spiritual life.
And sometimes we're afraid to get out of, as a group, I'm generalizing now, to get out of our own worship comfort space and go... try something.
Yeah.
Just see, And it's been a fruitful experience and a good opportunity to talk about that sort of thing.
I think it's neat to just going together to the weekly service. Like, they've done these studies. I went to this conference in Princeton, and they had sociologists who could almost, care less about the church, really. But, and they had some other people talking about who were very informed about church issues, but they were just looking at weekly church attendance. And it's interesting, families where they attend church weekly, they have a lower divorce rate and they have a higher rate of children in terms of certain categories of how you talk about how are children thriving in school, emotionally, intellectually. So it was interesting. And they said, they were wondering themselves, what is weekly service attendance? Sometimes it's boring. Sometimes people won't get anything out of it. Even when you don't get anything out, look at what happened in your discussion with your daughter. Hey, that's not quite right. But going there, they were talking, the sociologists didn't want to bring in the transcendent dimension or anything, but they were just saying, it's kind of interesting. You have to go together, and there's not a lot of things you go together to in the car all at the same time. You're going together as a family. You're talking in the car on the way. You go there. You meet some other people who affirm your kids or know your kids, so then it's a little more community. They also said just hearing about the problems of other people is very powerful for young people and families. You start thinking, my mother's so good. When we have certain problems, she always says, well, it could be worse. And there's part of that that's really kind of a healthy tool. It could be worse. Just hearing about the needs of other people, you don't get so self-absorbed.
Right.
And you can see that as a family. So it was so interesting. They were sort of taken aback by this. Because it's hard to measure religion. How do you measure a person's spirituality? The only way they could measure it statistically was, how often do you go to church? So then they had to use that tool and said, wow, a lot of interesting things are happening because of that. So even just doing that as a family is, I think, significant.
One thing I just wanted to mention, that because I was just looking at, since we're talking about how the church can support the parents and their teenage kids and all that, one thing that Eric, my husband, has been doing, he's been at our church now for 4 years, and it's a real small, convenient church, been around for 118 years, and it's been a process with everyone, with the council and everyone, so it's not just him bringing this in, but develop a thing around the different sacraments, and especially up around baptism. Parents will come in, we get baptized, and we want it done next week or whenever you're available. And he absolutely is insistent on this process of meeting with the parents several times, and has some really good resources for them, and it's an ongoing thing. And he and I personally give the baby a little book that we really like, Walt Langren one, or the child, it might not be a baby. And people are so resistant to that. But when they do accept this, maybe I'll do this, they grow in that. Mm-hmm. And because it's not just a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. And, it does that also with just everything, communion and all this. Talking about what is this? Why are we doing this? And how can this be an ongoing thing that the church, we are here to support you as parents, in this ongoing, lifelong path. But it just seems like that's I don't know how common or uncommon that is. I guess it's maybe becoming a little more common.
To take those transitions seriously.
Exactly.
Or like confirmation. Our church does a wonderful job. The parents have to come to a lot of things.
Yeah.
They're always talking. And they even have, like in Minnesota, they have that early child development classes where you come with your little tiny preschoolers, you play a little game together. Then the parents go off and you talk about parenting issues. It's run by the state. It's tremendous.
Oh, wow.
But it's almost like that for confirmation, because you come and you do something together as parents. Then the parents go off, they talk a while, and then they come back. But they know what their kids are reading. They can talk about it when they get home. That's a very good thing, I think, these transitions.
Have the parents coming every week?
Oh, yeah, for quite a few weeks. I think it's like something like 10 weeks.
Wow.
In one part of the confirmation. And they even have to go through a 14-week, it's a program on a Tuesday night if your child's going to be in it before you go into the program. 14 weeks you have to go every Tuesday night.
Wow.
So, I mean, I thought that was good. It was kind of saying, wow, this is important. I'm sorry, you got to get here. And it was very helpful. The parents then have to a kind of common language, talking about what's going on with the kids, what's our goal here with our kids. And there's not a lot of occasions you come together as parents talking, because I think we do think of families, like religion, as very private. Very private. Just what you think is best for your kid. But we need this resonance going on in the wider community. We found, too, small groups are really helpful. Like small groups of parents, maybe who have like toddlers and they're, you know, getting through that, or the adolescents that they meet as a, you know, these small groups within a church, those families, and that's very helpful. One, and I thought those are kind of helpful. Like, I talked to a woman named Linda Waite, who just wrote this book, The Case for Marriage. She's from University of Chicago, and she's a sociologist. And just talking about some of the positive things about marriage, and another sociologist who's saying, right, divorce in some cases is positive, but we need to really help families stay together. And she found such a neat statistic that people who are saying, I hate my marriage, I'm very unhappy in my marriage, if they stay in it for 5 years, that 86% of them are either happy or very happy after that 5 years. Mm-hmm. And we were saying, well, what keeps people in it? You know, when in the unhappy marriages, because most of them go then to the divorce, but what keeps the unhappy ones kind of in there through the ups and downs till you get back to where you're happy? And she was saying, a lot of it is just other people saying your marriage is important, either your family or your friends, saying, come on, stick it out. We went through this kind of thing. And that in those cases, it's not the marriage counselors who are helping so much. And this Bill Doherty, who is a marriage counselor, highly critical of his profession, interesting guy who wrote that Intentional Family that's on that green sheet. Very interesting guy in Minnesota. He says what he thought has been helping people is these support groups more, where a couple got through it, and then they share their experience. And I think the same is true with young kids. You know, if you could just at least affirm each other in a smaller group, hey, this is important, I'm going through this struggle, have ideas that you can share, I think that's another way.
There's some recent studies, too, that children really don't observe all the, I mean, most of the times it's really, really more important to stay in that marriage unless you're beating on each other, but
yeah,
for the kids' benefit, there is something really to
yes.
that.
That's why I was saying a lot of these studies, the sociologists, psychologists,
you may think it's
are
a
the
bad
ones,
atmosphere for
right.
kids,
you're saying
a lot of things they don't notice.
Okay. Right. Or they're saying, well, I'm unhappy, that won't make my kids unhappy.
Yeah.
They're not that unhappy if you're unhappy. They're unhappy if they don't have the structure.
Right.
If they don't
That's
have things
important.
In place.
Yeah.
And again, they're all very open about, in some cases, it is beneficial to the children in very high conflict or abusive. But in most cases, if we can try to help one another stick it out, and I think, too, the same with parenting. Maybe that would be one way to, you know, turn off the TV, but have other people
a little bit supporting you or sharing ideas about what do you do, what kind of rituals are you cultivating in your family to help pass on the faith. So, oh gosh, we're running out of time, but if you have other thoughts or you look at this and you say, gosh, why wasn't this part of the discussion about practicing things in the home? Why wasn't that part of the discussion? Or where would you put your money? I'd love to just hear, if you've got one lesson, where would you put your money if you said, let's start here, or you're on a committee, you know, to say, this would be the next step.
Part of me says that we're so timid about acting on what we say is most important.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like in our confirmation, we had an overnight retreat, and it was the best part of the confirmation year. Mm-hmm. And I saw new things in my small group. I only got 5 kids in my subgroup, you know. But to be with them for 24 hours just made all the world a difference. But one mom, her son had a baseball game, and she just about blew up.
Oh yeah.
When we said he would have to skip his game.
Uh-huh.
It was the most, she was just like, we had stabbed her in the back and you know, what was it, group murder going on, and she was there.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought to myself how people don't have time for those 14 weeks of meetings, whoever had that.
Yeah.
But, and we let them get away. We're so,
yeah.
We worship individual choice, and that becomes a group conspiracy against group commitment.
I really like, do you have a curriculum for those 14 weeks?
They do have that, uh-huh.
And that's the,
That's a, it's a, this individual church kind of made up of this
curriculum. Because
it has a school.
I'm not a Lutheran, but I'd love to see that curriculum.
Yeah.
Because I think that is one point in our church where we do, I mean, confirmation is very important. And I think if you said those parents have to attend, I think they would attend, actually.
And if they don't, they're probably the parents that would bring the kid in, drop them off, and say, okay, now let's see, you're 12 years old, you need to go to confirmation, and I'll be back when you're at 15, and then we'll go, and that'll be the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, our church was confirming kids whether they finished the requirements or not.
Yeah.
And now in the last few years, we've gotten much, 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 much better about it. And they even have a curriculum that carries them over the summer between the time they finish their classwork and the time they're actually confirmed. There's a daily Bible study, there's a lot of reading, and there's an I believe statement, and all of these things have timelines on them, and they've got to be done. And if you don't get it done, you don't get confirmed. And I am so happy that, you know, we were confirming it. That I don't even know why they were there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we do. I mean, we have a really small rural church, but we do have the camp, the church camp that's near us has a confirmation weekend in the fall, which is, you have that.
If you could analyze people's hours.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How can you have 27 hours for TV?
Mm-hmm.
And not an hour for church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it should be 27 hours for church.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in terms of values, you work backwards from how we spend our time to what our values are and try to mesh those two.
Mm-hmm.
And just be really forthright about it. I think, ironically, that's what the more, whatever they are, the evangelical churches, community churches, the non-denominational ones, they're not shy about time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in many cases, they're missing the boat on providing alternative to the culture, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's rah-rah religion, like your daughter said. I mean, it's entertainment religion in many cases. I'm sure that's not the answer. But how do you get that honesty about commitment?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have people
the expectation.
People would complain if you go 1 minute over 60.
Yeah.
Right. You know, church has to be 1 hour, and if you're here for 1 hour and 1 minute, the preacher talked too long, or there was too much music, or whatever. You know, I'm going to miss the kickoff of the Vikings.
Yeah.
Get whatever
it is.
Overtime.
Yeah.
But it's outrageous. It's outrageous.
I've been impressed with the
you know, there's some struggles, certainly the Missouri Synod has, but we're more a Missouri Synod country now. We live in Indiana, a lot of Missouri Synod in Fort Wayne, right near there. But we went to a church, visited a Missouri Synod church, and we've been at so many ELCA churches where they, you know, they welcome the visitors, and then they have sort of the one-hour welcome. And sometimes it's so thin, you can't even believe it. It's like one guy got up and said, well, now here's the structure of our committees in the church, and here's where you might get involved. There was nothing about addressing the spiritual yearning, you know, or anything. It was so funny. But there, it was like, oh, here's our church. And we have, like, if you are interested in joining, we have five sessions. They had 5 one-hour sessions just to introduce what's going on in the liturgy. Why do we do it that way? What's going on with the music? What do we say about kids and families?
Right.
What do we say is important? Why do we think it's important coming to church? It was so interesting. It was like, whoa, we're stepping into something.
It was Missouri Synod.
Yeah, it was Missouri Synod Church. And I thought we have something to learn that way, just like the more conservative churches, just to say, hey, we have something to teach here, something, you know, worthwhile spiritually, morally, and so we need some time to talk to you about it.
So what that kind of reminds me of the catechumenate process that I just have been learning about in the last couple of years, but it's just going back to the very early church. I mean, it's been around, you know, the whole time, but just because we were talking about this catechumenate retreat, about that very thing. Well, actually, the first thing I thought you were saying, but then it turned out to be really a good thing, the five-session thing, but where it's just like a superficial sort of thing. Well, here's what, here people come into church, and then it's like, well, here's the committees, and here's this, and here's this, and this. And there are all these people, especially like the people in their 20s, who are seeking,
searching.
They call them
spiritually.
They want depth.
Mm-hmm.
They want something real,
mm-hmm.
something that has meaning, and that they are willing. And one guy, there was a guy that said something like, I want something I would die for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he really meant it.
Mm-hmm. What was the committee?
And, exactly.
What committee was that? The guy
was right.
Another important point is you only get one chance with those people.
That's right. In fact, this woman, because I was talking about postmodern church and all, or postmodern, I mean, I'm really bad on all the terminology, I'm just learning it, but this person had an agenda. She this was her Sunday. She was going to try this particular church. If she didn't like it, she had, and she told the pastor this, you know, next time I'm going to try it, and she was going to try something with Buddhism, and she had, you know, wasn't even within the Christian realm. She wanted a spiritual path to follow. She was willing to commit, like, her life, you know, but it had to really mean something to her.
Mm-hmm.
And this church got, like, this one chance.
Mm-hmm.
And families, I think, so that ties into families, too, and young single people, but also families, they're really seeking
mm-hmm.
something that will meet their...
Yeah.
Well, and they say if the children were really excited, the parents would stay. But
mm-hmm.
if the kids don't have anything but to say, they'll keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're deferring to their children. They're looking for something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of maturation goes on as adults, as you parent.
Oh, right.
So that opportunity, you know, is so rich to have the children, but then maturing yourself as an adult, as your parent, is so important too. You mature, you ask a lot of new kinds of spiritual questions, I think, as your parent.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, gosh, thank you for, I think we got to go to lunch now, isn't it? But gosh, thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.